Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we will be talking some about Native American art and about how those works fit into the history of all American art, and perhaps how people have thought about that and how their ideas on that subject have changed over time. And our guest for the program is Janet Catherine Burlow. Her special area of interest, one of her special areas of interest, are the arts of the indigenous people of the Americas. She's professor of art history at the University of Rochester. A woman here has been spending some time on the campus as a Miller Endowment Professor and Distinguished Mellon Scholar in Residence. She's the author of a number of books. I just want to mention a couple, one being Native North American Art, which she co-authored with Ruth Phillips and was published by Oxford University Press in 1998. So it's a good survey work if you're interested. She also herself is very interested in quilting, and another book might interest you is Wild by Design, 200 Years of Innovation and Artistry in American Quilts, which she co-authored with Patricia Cruz, was published by University of Washington Press in 2003. I do also want to mention, too, that she will be giving a talk in the MillerCom series dealing with the kinds of subjects we'll be talking about here this morning, but that's about a month away. That'll be on April 19th at 7:30 in the evening in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. And these programs are always free. They're open to the public, so anybody who would like to attend should certainly feel welcome. And here on the program, too, if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it. You know, just recently, in the past couple of weeks, I spent a little time in Ithaca at Cornell, the home of Cornell. And one of the things that I did was I spent some time at their art museum. And they have a very nice museum. I don't know if
you've
been
yes.
there. Very dramatic, modern building designed by I.M. Pei. So it's a very handsome place. And on one floor, they have their East Asian collection. On one floor, it's all European works. On one floor, it's all art that was produced in the United States. And they also had on display a small collection of art from Africa and also some pre-Columbian, which was also, I think that it was also from, always all from Central and South America. And I didn't really think about this very much at the time, but I'm certainly thinking about it now as I was getting ready to talk to you. There was nothing produced by Indian people of North America. And I would assume that probably somewhere on the campus, there are some things, but I'm guessing that they're someplace else. They're in some other kind of museum, and that this is probably fairly typical of the way that people have thought about Native American art, at least artists that's produced by artists in the past, any time before the 20th century.
Yeah, what you describe is fairly typical of a lot of museums, although not all. And sometimes it's interesting to note that people don't realize that thoughts about Native American art have changed more than once in the 20th century. For example, if you look back at all of the popular art magazines of the 1920s and 30s, that was a time when intelligent, art-loving Americans were ready to embrace Native American art. It appeared in the pages of art magazines. It appeared in galleries on Madison Avenue. The Museum of Modern Art had a very influential show called Indian Art of the United States in 1941 that was covered by every newspaper and magazine you could think of. And then a kind of historical amnesia set in, and Native American art was sort of forgotten in the 50s and 60s, rediscovered a little bit in the 70s. But it's true that you more often find it in anthropology museums. But if you look back at some of the key museums, art museums in this country, the Cleveland Museum of Art, the St. Louis Art Museum, the Houston Museum of Fine Arts, they all have some things that were acquired in the 20s, and then maybe they put them away for a long time. I don't know the particular history at Cornell, because sometimes university museums, it's a matter of individual donors.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a point, and I think that this came maybe in the second half of the 19th century, when institutions, universities, important museums began to collect. And although it seems that the way they thought about these things were they thought about them as important cultural artifacts,
yes,
things that were worth study and conservation. They mm-hmm. thought, well, it was important to protect these things. But they didn't really think about them as art in the – and we can talk about what we mean when we say something is a work of art. But they really didn't think about them that way.
No, they saw them as anthropological artifacts. And there are marvelous collections that were put together at that time. The Field Museum in Chicago has an extraordinary collection, for example. But the Art Institute has a very small room devoted to Native American art, and most of that belongs to a private collector who has it on long-term loan. Mm-hmm. And it has actually always irked me that the indigenous arts of our own country are not as valued as much as they should be, I think.
Yeah.
And this is true also in universities. You know, in my field, we always worry about how to educate the next generation in our field, and there are very few places where you can get a PhD and study with a specialist in Native American art. So it sort of perpetuates the marginalization of the field.
Yeah. Well, it did. It does. And now, as I say, now that I think about it, it does strike me as curious that, for example, in this museum, and it probably would be true of others, that you would have, say, African art, but not and also things that had been produced by indigenous people of South America, but not of North America. I mean, what does that say about the way that we think about all of these things?
Well, if you're talking about the Krannert Museum, I've been so busy in my schedule here teaching and lecturing that I only got to spend a few minutes looking at their collections. But in fact, they have a very nice room devoted to American decorative arts in which some very important Pueblo pottery by Maria Martinez is exhibited there as part of American decorative arts, which is as I think it should be, because it was an intercultural art. It was made for outsiders and should be part of what we consider the American heritage.
Well, was there something in the history of American art or the history of American art history? I mean, was there some important turning point when people started to think differently about this art, started to pay attention to it, or started to say, yes, this deserves to be treated not just as a kind of archaeological artifact, but also as a work of art in every sense of the word?
Yes, that happened at different places at different times, but I was trained in the 1970s at Yale, and those of us who were interested in what was then called primitive art were expected to cover all of those arts, the arts of Africa, Oceania, and the Americas. So, in fact, I was trained in pre-Columbian art and archaeology with a minor in African art. I'm completely self-taught in Native American art because there was no one to teach me those art histories. And I think my experience is not unusual. I think a year or two ago you had my dear friend and colleague Ruth Phillips on the air here, and she, in fact, was trained in African art in London. Mm-hmm. And when she came back to Canada to start her professional career, she became very interested in Native American art, and she was self-taught. And we always keep hoping that that it will change, you know, over the generations. And there are some universities now that are more open to it, but times are tight economically. So often when my students are looking for jobs, they often see job ads that say things like, looking for an Americanist who can also teach one or two of the following: African American art, Native American art, Hispanic American art. So it's still kind of an also, you know, get two for one rather than looking for a historian of Native American art.
Well, and I suppose that also points to the fact that we do the same kind of thing with other kinds of art that you touch on. That is, there may be special collections of art by Latinos and art by African Americans or art by Asian Americans, and somehow they get put off into another kind of corner. So it's sort of this idea that there would be this enormous field of American art and that all of this can be a part of that and it should be a part of it. We still seem to be wanting to compartmentalize and say, well, this is sort of special. It's out of the mainstream. It's somehow kind of different.
I think that's changing, though. I'm part of a team of scholars who are publishing a book called American Encounters, and it's really a global history of American art for the 21st century. It's coming out through the textbook publisher Prentice Hall next fall. And some of us have been working on this for 10 years, and we were really committed from the beginning to not having the separate narrative of Native American art, the separate narrative of African American art. So there is a chapter on art before Europeans came to this country where I talk mainly about the interrelationships, economic, cultural, artistic, among the indigenous groups of the Americas. But once Europeans come to this country, bringing with them African slaves, then you've got a dynamic set in motion that involves people from Africa, indigenous people of this world, Europeans of many different sorts. And so we've been trying to look at this art all as a conversation rather than as separate ghettoized movements. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you know, some people who go to the Southwest and they see beautiful Pueblo pottery or Pueblo jewelry, and they see the wonderful adobe architecture that Pueblo people have been making for well over 1,000 years. They want somehow, for whatever yearnings we as European Americans have, they want to think of this as a pristine, pure culture. Well, you know, the Pueblos were overrun by the Spanish in early 16th century, and many of them intermarried, and some of them became Catholic. And the story's far too complicated to tell any sort of simple story that's about we're pure Native Americans or we're pure African Americans. You know, I think maybe we're passing out of the period where people want to have that kind of simple-minded identity politics, but it's much more complicated than that. And, you know, I think a lot of people recognize that in their own heritage they have a very mixed and complicated heritage. Well, that's true of many Native Americans, too.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Janet Catherine Burlow. She's professor of art history at the University of Rochester and is particularly interested in the art of indigenous North America. And she's here visiting the campus, spending some time as a Miller Endowment professor and also distinguished Mellon scholar in residence. And we'll be giving a talk about this very issue later next month on the 19th. Right? 19th of April. Yes, April 19th. A talk in the MillerCom series. So people in and around Champaign-Urbana can attend that. And then here this morning on the program, questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
Can I plug a talk I'm actually giving this afternoon?
Oh, yeah, sure.
At 5 o'clock at the Krannert Art Museum Auditorium. I'm giving a talk that, again, is free and open to the public. It's called Returning the Gaze, and it is about drawings done by late 19th century Plains Indian artists. We always think of people like Edward Curtis, the great photographer whose big project was photographing American Indians. We always think of Euro-Americans chronicling what Native Americans looked like. Well, in their drawings, it turns out Plains Indians were also very interested in what Euro-Americans, African-Americans, and other Indian tribes were like. And so I'm talking about that sort of turning of the mirror to look back at how did Indian artists see these rather odd people, all of, you know, the military men, all of whom dressed alike. Wasn't that strange? In Plains Indian culture, each warrior dressed in a very idiosyncratic manner that reflected his history, his military exploits. And yet here come all these men in blue, all dressed alike, and then they march in formation. Very, very odd customs these people have. And we see this chronicled in drawings, sometimes in a very humorous way.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting because I suppose when people think about Native American art, they probably don't think about works on paper.
Right.
But there is indeed this tradition, and it was a case where here was a new material came along that perhaps people had not been familiar with before, paper, pencils, things
right.
like that. But they said, well, fine. This works really well. We can do this,
right.
And again, maybe that'd be the kind of thing where it's going to be a little bit more ephemeral than some other material. So who knows how much material has been lost? But there is a significant body of this kind of works on paper.
Exactly, and in addition to the fact that artists in any culture are curious about new materials and new ways of doing things that other peoples have, there was also the very real problem that for a people who had painted particularly on buffalo hides, their medium, their material for working with was, hunted to the point of extinction at the end of the 19th century. So they needed a new material.
Hmm. So, You know, something else that occurs to me, and I wonder if this somehow does, somehow also gets in the way of thinking about the art of Native Americans, and that is that we sometimes make this what is maybe an artificial distinction between art and craft,
mm-hmm.
and that we have this idea that a work of art is something that exists solely to be pleasing or maybe to be provocative, not necessarily, but the idea is that its function is just to be what it is, and that if there is something that is useful and beautifully made, that somehow that's not art, and that a lot of the things that we're talking about are indeed things that have some sort of function other than mm-hmm. simply to be mm-hmm. beautiful, and we don't think about that the same way.
Mm-hmm. And yet, Michelangelo's Sistine ceiling had a number of different functions, didn't it? It had a religious function. It had an economic function to show the power of the church. Mm-hmm. You know, so it depends how we define functionality. But what you say is exactly right, and I think people in any crafts tradition today. I was talking to a student metal worker at the university here, and I was asking her if she felt that divide between the studio arts and the craft arts, and she didn't seem to find it so much. So maybe it's changing. She said, "Well, you know, we're taught that our things have to be aesthetically beautiful and functional and have a meaning and a reason for being." And so maybe we're getting past that art craft distinction, because that's such an old and overworked topic that I don't think it has so much meaning for people anymore.
Mm-hmm. Does here is another question. Again, I'm sure all of these are questions you could spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about. But again, when we think about who is an artist and what their intention is, mm-hmm. if we think about the people that made things in the past, the Native American artists, how did they think about what they were doing, and would they have thought about themselves as being an artist in the way that we think about that word and we use that word?
Well, I'm not an expert on this, certainly, but that word has its rise in the Renaissance in Italy, and so it really comes out of a particular time or place, and I would say that probably for 9/10 of the world, the people who have made beautiful objects over the last 5,000 years have not thought of themselves in the way that we use the word artist. So to me, that's a little bit immaterial. I mean, there was a while when a lot of contemporary Native American artists were having very earnest discussions about what does it mean that in our languages there is no word for art?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course there are words that say, you know, to make something in a spiritual manner, to make something that pleases the gods, to make something, you know, beautiful and watertight and so forth. So I think all of those intentions or impulses are there.
Yeah, whether you have a word for it or not. Well, let's talk with some callers here. We have several. We'll start out with someone in Belgium, not the country, but the town. It's not all that far away from here. Line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Good morning to you all. I'm sure Mr. Inge knows that we've spoke about this before, but the truly indigenous people of this area left artifacts laying on the ground in form of weapons, form of games they played, many things like that were left, sometimes in funerary goods, many times just left at the campsites where they were at, and they wandered on someplace else is the only thing we can assume that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you've just brought up the aspect as whether it's art or not, but some of these things are just amazing pieces of stonework.
Yes, they are.
Obviously, they weren't made with metal or things like that, but they were stonework, and they're just phenomenally made. Surely they must have been considered as art at that time, too, because they took it to the grave with them, and you know, they, as offerings for their souls or whatever they used it for.
Yes, that's very well put. And in fact, if you look at some of this ancient stonework, it's clear that probably 50, 60, 70 pieces of stone were rejected before they picked the beautiful gnarled or marbled or whatever the word is, piece of stone that they were going to cut into one of these objects, so that the tools were sometimes made more for their beauty than for their functionality. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yes, exactly. Many were used for everyday articles, though, too. That they're things called effigy pipes, and if you've ever seen them,
sure,
they're made exactly like the animal they're expected to represent, and yet they still used them for smoking whatever they smoked at that time. And same way with the banner stones, the things called banner stones. They were used as weights for their throwing stones to increase the velocity of their weapons, but yet they decorated them.
Yes, I couldn't think of the word banner stone, but that's what I was thinking of when I was talking about the, you know, rejecting so many different pieces of stone before you picked the really beautiful one to use. And in I don't know about the ancient people of this area, but in other parts of North America, there are wonderful traditions that animals will only allow themselves to be hunted either with beautiful, well-made weapons or by men who are dressed beautifully by skin clothing that their wives have made, so that the issue of aesthetics is even important to animals in a Native American worldview, and that you're honoring the animals by being well-dressed and having beautiful animals when you go to hunt them.
Yes, so the history of that art is kind of lost to us in a way, isn't it? I mean, truly, they really only know what they meant by their art, didn't they?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's true of any ancient tradition. Archaeologists from any part of the world deal with that, especially with non-literate traditions, that we can strive to put ourselves in their shoes, or we can strive to think about what they might have wanted. And interestingly, I find it's often artists, contemporary artists, who collect the kind of materials you're talking about and who really appreciate the beauty of some of these ancient tools because they understand what it means to make them.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. You know, this the banner stone, this is something that is new to me. I was looking at a survey text that you co-authored, and there is a photograph of one of these things in the book that just knocked me out completely. This thing, it's a couple of thousand years old, and yet if you showed someone a picture of that today and you told them that it was a contemporary piece of contemporary sculpture.
Right, Brancusi made it. They'd say,
yeah,
okay.
They never saw, they'd say, okay. The shape is extraordinary, and the way that the artist took advantage of its stone, and there is what I would call a grain,
yes,
in the stone. The way that the artist took advantage of that, so made an extraordinarily beautiful thing in its shape. The way that the artist took advantage of the material and in its inherent qualities, it's just stunning. It's a stunning thing, and then it's even somehow more stunning when you say, oh, and by the way, the person who made this was a couple thousand years ago.
Right. And it had a functional use as well as being beautiful.
So that I suppose that goes some way to say that the aesthetic, something that we now think of and recognize as an aesthetic sense, must be really ingrained and fundamental to
I think it's hardwired to human beings. And I say that being completely ignorant of neurology or, you know, brain science. But as an art historian, I want to put forward the idea that we're all hardwired as aesthetic beings.
Yeah, okay. let's talk with someone in Charleston, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to move the conversation 360 degrees. And speaking of art and indigenous peoples and the continuity of human society, I think if I've heard correctly, some things are lost. You know, we don't know. I've not studied the art of Neanderthal peoples or if any of that exists. But if we begin there and project ahead the 360 degrees, I keep thinking of the term homogenous. Western man, you know, who now dominates the world, and art and politics and economics and the whole thing, and with Mr. Bush's drive towards democratizing, what a term. But in any case, it appears to me, or occurs to me, that somehow that all those qualities in human hardwiring, to use your word, is going to be lost. And we all, it's getting that way now with television and communications and the internet and such as that, that all these things that are driven into one audience, people possess those things, and the homogenization of the aesthetics and all the other endeavors of human beings seems to me that that's where we're going. How quickly we get there, I don't know, but it occurs to me that that's what's happening.
Well, I certainly understand your concern with the homogenization of culture, but I try to take some comfort in the fact that you can read wise people from 1,000 years ago or from the ancient Greeks who expressed the same fear, you know, that the younger generation isn't concerned with art or religion anymore, the younger generation isn't concerned with philosophy, and yet somehow we seem to keep going, you know, aesthetically. I certainly worry about the world politically, but in terms of losing our aesthetic sense, that I don't worry about, interestingly enough.
Well, and it's certainly the case that if you just take the area in which you work, there certainly are contemporary Native American artists doing very unique and bold and cutting-edge work that use modern materials and have sort of modern sentiments, mm-hmm. and at the same time deal with traditional values and the questions that they wrestle with that have to do with their experience being Native Americans. And it's still, you know, it's a very distinct body of work. So you can't, you know, you can't really say that somehow things have become so fuzzy that everything is sort of the same and that all artists everywhere are doing the same thing, because I don't really think that that's true.
No, and you know, I certainly have friends among the contemporary Native art community, some of which, as you say, do very interesting cutting-edge work. And I asked one of them once, I said, Gerald, when you go back to your reserve in Western Canada, what do your grandparents think about the kind of art that you make? He says, they get it. They understand it completely. They understand how it relates to our values and our customs. He said, it's only outsiders who think that this is different from the tradition of Native American art. The old people always get it, which I thought was fascinating.
And are there still people who do practice traditional
yes.
craft work, so that those ways of doing things and those kinds of things are still being made?
Yes. I mean, there are some craft traditions that in which we have a completely unbroken line of tradition. Some people who've probably traveled to the Southwest have seen the beautiful painted Pueblo pots that mostly women make in the Southwest. Many of those are formed by hand the same way they were 1,000 years ago. They're painted by hand with yucca leaf brushes the way they were 1,000 years ago. And yet other Pueblo artists do things completely differently in a very modern vein. And then in some areas you have the rediscovery of ancient traditions. Up in the Alaskan Arctic, many women lost the art of doing seal intestine or seal gut waterproof parkas because, you know, when Gore-Tex came along, that was pretty good. But in fact, their ancestresses were making waterproof seal gut parkas hundreds of years ago. They made them for the Russian sea captains who came across the Bering Sea, because the Russians realized immediately that this was much better than their wool coats when you were out in a driving rain. But there were, you know, a few old ladies left who knew how to do it, and now there's a younger generation of women saying, you know, we don't have to do this for practical reasons anymore, but it sure is wonderful to know how to do this and to know how to do all the technology. And there are workshops, and on the Pacific Coast, there are basketry workshops where women are teaching younger women how to find the right kind of materials and make baskets in a very laborious way. Although sometimes this brings up very pressing ecological issues, because with all our private property today, you can't necessarily just go anywhere you want foraging for basketry materials. You might be thrown off people's lands, or with issues of pollution or global warming, the materials may be disappearing. So some basket makers find they end up becoming political activists about ecological issues because they don't have access to their materials anymore. So art can lead in a lot of directions.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. I have a couple of calls we'll get right to. I do want to introduce, however, again, our guest. Maybe some people might have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes. We're talking with Janet Catherine Burlow. She is professor of art history at the University of Rochester, and she's interested in the art of the indigenous peoples of North America. She's also very much interested in American quilt history and 19th century visual culture and has written books on both subjects. She is spending some time here on the campus of the University of Illinois as a Miller Endowment Professor and Distinguished Mellon Scholar in Residence. She will be giving a talk in the MillerCom series dealing with some of these issues that we're talking about here, moving toward a more inclusive American art history. That'll be on April 19th, 7:30 in the evening, at the Spurlock Museum. Also today at 5 o'clock at the auditorium of the Krannert Art Museum, she'll be giving a talk about Native American work on paper and the effort of Native American artists to use that medium to record some of their experiences, talk about their life.
At the end of the 19th century.
At the end of the 19th century. And that's open to anybody who would like to attend. You should assert both of these talks free, open to the public. You can just stop by there. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And let's talk with someone else, someone here in Urbana, where we are, line number two. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good.
I just wanted to make a quick comment and tell you about something that happened with me that was very, very powerful. It was actually when I was in my undergraduate, I had an art degree from Western, but my teacher had brought in a Lakota tribe artist for our department and was doing work with us, and you know, I got kind of hired out, you know, mixing all the paints and stretching canvases and doing all the legwork so that essentially this visiting artist could simply just work. But I had about a month where I was working with him, and it was an absolutely fascinating experience because I had a chance to talk to him over hours and hours for an entire month about why he was doing what he was doing. And it was kind of an experience that just kind of changed me because I started to realize that art can provide an identity. While that was good for me because I was trying to find myself. He was still trying to find himself, and he talked about feelings of feeling like he was a fraud. He was trying to do work that was very, very natural for his ancestors and was just simply a part of life, but now it's something that has to be sought after and fought for. And it was very difficult for him being part of such a marginalized minority. I mean, really, take a moment and reflect. When was the last time in casual society you met and had an opportunity to converse with a Native American Indian? It's one of the smallest minorities in the country. And it gave me this profound sense of respect for the work because it gives you a viewpoint that can't necessarily be expressed with words. When you're before these kinds of works, you're realizing that you're having an opportunity to look into a person that's trying to express an experience that is so difficult to encompass that sometimes art's the only way. But the work that he was doing was trying to rediscover the language of his ancestors to try and find a way to mimic them and through mimicking them, understand them and empathize with them. And once he can empathize with them, to be able to express his own feelings. But it's been a very powerful experience, so I just wanted to say that I'm very, very glad that art historian has taken this upon themselves to expand the work.
Oh, thank you so much. And it was interesting to hear you talk because I think any time you have a chance to be an apprentice to an artist of whatever tradition, you see that artists do always continue to try and find themselves and stretch themselves and push themselves. And if you're from a particular minority position, you have other burdens that add to that, but you're absolutely right that art is one of the great ways to do it.
And pardon the phrase, a good way to walk a mile in a man's moccasins.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'll go ahead and hang up now.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to Spring Bay. This is another caller here on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a view that traditional or tribal artists were, if you look at a community or a society as a circle, they were in the middle, and all arrows pointed into them. In other words, they were in complete harmony or communicating with the people of their culture. And modern art, modernism, the artist is on the edge of the circle or maybe even outside the circle, the avant-garde. And it just seems curious to me that we've arrived at this position, and just wondered if you had any comments to make on the role or the position of artists in traditional or tribal as opposed to our more diverse or modern culture.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that in modern Western culture, for the past couple of hundred years, the model has been that the artist should be in opposition to society, on the outside of society. And sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. But I worry that your characterization of the native or the indigenous artist is maybe a bit too romantic. I think certainly in many native communities, the artists are meant to express the values of the entire culture. In other societies, artists were shamans or rather solitary spiritual figures who suffered and battled with the powers of nature and did have a very solitary road. So it's, I think it's also important not to generalize when we're talking about some 500 nations. But I would say that, yes, what you have to say is certainly true in some societies and in many respects. But I think one of the things that, although anthropology has given us many wonderful insights into Native cultures, one of the things that the discipline of anthropology is guilty of in the way that it used to be practiced is that it spent very little attention looking at the individual. And I think in any society in the world, an individual can make a big change, can turn things in a different direction. And certainly in Native American art, there have been cases where that has been true, where one individual's way of doing things or one individual's innovation has taken the work in a new direction. So I think that's one of the contributions that art history can make. We're more willing to look at the role of the individual. And I always like to make sure when I'm talking about Native American art of the historic period, if we know somebody's name, I always try and mention it, if we know somebody's name in history, because so very often people think that these things are anonymous, that they were just group production without any ego involved, and yet that is seldom the case. You usually find in traditional societies that people recognize the work of individuals. It's just that they didn't sign their names on the backs of things or the bottoms of things until the 20th century.
Okay. Well, very interesting. I'll keep listening. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we'll go to Urbana. This is line number one for another caller here. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering whether the U of I had in their collections any surviving aesthetic materials from Illinois tribes?
Well, you know, I'm a visitor here, and I've only been here 10 days, and they've kept me so very busy, I haven't had a chance to find that out. I wish I knew.
I suppose maybe the Field Museum might have.
Oh, I'm sure the Field Museum does.
Things. Okay, that was my question. And it seems like we ought to, if especially given all this chief controversy going on, and it's interesting that I don't know. Okay, take care.
All right. About 10 minutes left again in this part of Focus 580. We are talking again with Janet Catherine Burlow. She's professor of art history at the University of Rochester and is spending some time here on the campus of the University of Illinois. Her particular area of interest, one of them at least, is the art of indigenous peoples of North America. And as I mentioned, she's also a quilter and has written about that, about quilting in America. So that's another thing that she's interested in. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Not very long ago, within the past couple of months, I talked with someone who wrote a book about cave paintings, those that we find in, they find them in Spain and in France. And people probably have seen representations of some of these images, and they're really, really beautiful. And one of the interesting things about the cave paintings is that they have paintings that were done over a very long period of time in a very consistent style. So there was actually, if you will, there was a school of of this kind of art, and that certainly there must have been a way for it to be taught, for someone to be a master and then to teach it to someone else and to teach it to someone else, because it just, it's a very consistent, unbroken tradition over a very long period of time. And one of the things that I asked him sort of jokingly was, you know, were they no rebel artist cave painters? And he said, well, apparently not. No, there weren't. When you look at Native American art, do you see those kinds of examples, things where there's something that's a fairly consistent kind of tradition, and that you come across something, though, you say, this person was an outsider of their time, they're in what they were doing? Or do you not see that kind of thing?
That's a very good question. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons we need more people studying Native American art, because we need to pay attention to those sorts of things. People are just beginning to look at Southwestern pottery, for example, archaeological pottery, and be able to determine different artists' hands, something that's, you know, that's very old-fashioned and almost passé in European art. But it's exciting to us in Native American art to be able to determine different artistic traditions. Although, if I can answer your question more with a joke, you're talking about the cave paintings, reminds me of one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons ever, that shows two prehistoric women standing inside a cave with their tools, and there are the bison on the wall, and they look at each other and say, why do you think there are no famous men artists? So there's lots we don't know about cave painting and other ancient traditions.
Clearly that is true. That, and unfortunately, you're in a position of making what might be just informed guesses, but indeed guesses about so many of the things we have about who made them, about the circumstances under which they were made, and maybe also something about, well, what did it mean to them, this object? You just have to kind of surmise, I suppose, based on everything you know about their culture and everything you know about what it means to be an artist.
Yes.
And maybe assume that what we think of as, you know, as being an artist, yeah, that they probably thought about it the same way.
Yeah, I have sometimes during my career collaborated on projects both with Native artists and with non-Native artists. And to me, that's always fascinating, because somebody who really understands materials and techniques and how you can push materials and techniques looks at things in a very careful, different way. And in fact, I'm married to an industrial designer who went to Rhode Island School of Design. And it's always fascinating to me to look at things with him, because when he holds a human-made object in his hands, he has a whole inventory of the history of manufacture and how something was made and all sorts of information that I wouldn't otherwise have access to. Just as when I was studying these Plains Ledger drawings in great detail, you know, I'm a suburban girl from Massachusetts. I was on a pony once in my life, but I have two friends who are horsewomen, and I started showing these drawings to them because, of course, the drawings are filled with horses from the Great Plains, and they were able to show me that the artists were really telling you very specific information about these horses in terms of the way their legs were, what the horsemen were doing to control the horses, things that I was completely blind to. So that's why I think collaboration is such a good thing in my field. You know, I've collaborated on projects with Native historians and Native artists and with other sorts of people, because it always helps to have multiple eyes and multiple brains working on something.
Yeah. Let's talk with some other callers. Champagne is next. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. This goes back to your earlier discussion about why, you know, the lack of recognition for Native Americans. I think it unfortunately it's because of the Americans, as Americans, excluding Native Americans, false image of the Native Americans. You know, the point I'm getting at is that this negativism that we've had develop all these years about Native Americans and lack of knowledge about them. The other part that I found interesting is that I believe it's still there, but at the Art Institute they have a huge collection. It was donated by, I don't recall which developer, but a huge collection of paperweights. I mean, it tells you something about, you know, or anything that you want to comment on there.
Well, paperweights, I don't have anything to say about. I'm just completely speechless on the subject of paperweights. And certainly you're right in terms of the prejudices that have been brought to bear on Native peoples, especially in the last 150 years or so. When I teach, I give a lecture about images of Indians from the 17th and 18th centuries in which they were often seen as aristocrats of the Americas. Some of these individuals traveled to England and were celebrated and met Queen Anne and so forth. And yet, I think the legacy of prejudice that we have dates from the time of the Plains Indian Wars, where in the popular imagination and in the popular press, there were political reasons to characterize Indian peoples as savages. And that has stuck, and most people don't even know that there was an earlier history that involved talking about, and I'm not talking about the old view of the noble savage, that's something else entirely, but thinking about Native people as aristocrats who went to Europe and met their equals, that met the aristocrats of Europe. That's a chapter in our history we don't usually learn.
Mm. We're very short on time. I want to try to get one more caller here, Terre Haute, over in Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a friend down in Arizona who collects Native American art, but only art which the Native American is shown smiling. And those pictures are very, very rare, and I wonder why.
Well, that's interesting. I think in 19th century photography and in 19th century painting, you don't see a lot of smiling people of whatever ethnicity, because having your portrait painted or having your portrait snapped was very serious business. So all of the grinning and laughter that goes on in photography today is really a phenomenon of the 20th century. My book on Native North American art has on the cover a beaded portrait of a Plains man and woman with very serious faces, and it looks like it was modeled on a photograph. And initially the editor at Oxford said, well, I don't think we want this picture. The people are not smiling. And I had to say to him, well, you know, usually they didn't smile in those images.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate the comments of the caller. We're just about the point that we're going to have to finish, maybe a minute or so left. Just as a kind of a general question, let me ask, in what way do you think that the enterprise of doing art history, American art history, benefits from being more inclusive and folding in to the larger business, art by Native Americans?
Native Americans and everyone else who has come to this country.
Yeah.
I mean, the Native Americans are the original Americans, of course, and then, well, you know, we've had a terribly complicated situation since then, but to reflect the realities of history and of life, we have to show a complicated view of art, and scholars are getting better and better at that. And if I can put in a plug for our conference in April, we are going to have the most diverse and interesting group of smart scholars, some of them just out of graduate school, some of them more senior, who will address this very issue.
Yeah. And there is now a strong community of contemporary Native American artists.
Oh, yes.
How many? Is this indeed a thriving, large, thriving tradition?
Yes. You know, it varies. In the Southwest, it's very large and lots of people. And then there are pockets everywhere across North America, you know, lots of urban artists. Sometimes people think of Indian artists as being the ones that are out on the reservations or, you know, down in Santa Fe. But there are Indian artists all across North America.
Well, there we will stop. If you're interested, by the way, in a survey of Native North American art, you might look for the book of that title published by the Oxford University Press, co-authored by our guest, Janet Catherine Burlow. Or if you're interested in quilting, you might look at her book, Wild by Design, 200 Years of Innovation and Artistry in American Quilts. Are you still doing quilting yourself?
When I have time, it makes me happy.
All right. Janet Catherine Burlow is professor of art history at the University of Rochester. She's spending some time here at University of Illinois. This afternoon at 5, she'll be talking about some Native American works on paper from the late 19th century, right? That's at 5 o'clock in the auditorium of the Krannert Art Museum. So anybody who is interested in can stop by. Also, I shall be talking about the effort to be more inclusive with American art history and include art by Native Americans. That's at the Spurlock Museum, the Knight Auditorium, April 19th. That's a Thursday, 7:30 in the evening. It's an event in the MillerCom series. So anybody who is interested should feel welcome to attend. And again, thanks very much for being
here. My pleasure. Thank you.